Berylum Sports.
Hello again and welcome to this very special 100th episode of Berylum Sport Podcasting. And I've worked quite hard as well as the production team at Berylum Sport, and we tried to assemble a bit of a galaxy of stars. One of those is David Crofty Croft, the voice of F1 in Sky. David, welcome to Berylum Sports. Thanks for your time. How are you keeping?
I'm very well, Tony. How are you this afternoon, my friend?
Doing A-okay. I was saying to you just a moment ago, it's a strange world we're living in, so I count my blessings, David, but not too bad.
Yeah, it's been a strange old year. There was a time where some of us felt that we might not be going to any F1 Grand Prix this year, and we'd barely get a season together. But as we're talking at the moment, we've had 13 rounds, four to go. Lewis Hamilton's dominating, Mercedes are dominating. Oh, it's just like it always is, isn't it?
It's nice to know some things are normal in our world, or at least ordinary. I'm delighted you brought that up, of course. And Stevenage's own Lewis Hamilton is inexorably moving towards a seventh world title, equaling, of course, the great Schumacher. I think he just needs to avoid losing by 7 points to his teammate Bottas at the weekend. Just put into context that achievement.
Well, I think for all of us in this world, we like to think that we're consistent. We like to think that we do a good job day in, day out. And to be fair, we do. But a lot of us don't do it under the scrutiny, the pressure, and the excellence that has to be attained each and every time we go out to do our job, to be able to do our job in the way that we do. And I think that the way I like to look at it with Lewis Hamilton, he isn't just a naturally talented athlete. He's also a man that has to work incredibly hard in a very technical sport. So it's your physical fitness, it's your mental fitness. And together with his team, and we should never ever discount the input that the Mercedes team have had into Lewis Hamilton's career. McLaren at first, Mercedes since he went there in 2013. And the way that every single part of that team matches the work ethic that Lewis has to go that extra mile to be able to do their jobs as well as they do, both at Brackley where they make the chassis, and Brixworth where they make the engine. And they've all come together to produce this superhuman team performance, where man and machine is allowed to go out and excel on the track, because Lewis has had teammates in Nico Rosberg and Valtteri Bottas, who, if Lewis is having a bad day, invariably they're having a good day. And in Nico Rosberg's case in 2016, won the world title. But Lewis has managed to rise above the threshold of drivers who win the odd world title, who win a world title and then win one a couple of years later. Sebastian Vettel, in my early career covering Formula One, managed four on the trot. Well, Lewis Hamilton is matching that and some at the moment, 2014, 2015, 17, 18, 19, and 2020 as well. It is all going to come Lewis Hamilton's way this year because of his talent and his application of that talent on the track and off it when he needs to. Now, he's found a way to divert some of the pressure away from him off the track by indulging in a number of extracurricular activities, shall we say, his fashion collection, his music that he's very much got into now. Before COVID, of course, people thought he was just a superstar that likes hanging around with rappers. Well, he does like hanging around with rappers, and he's got some very famous friends. But that is Lewis's life, and it's a release almost from the pressures of Formula One. If he has a bad race, he's got to wait at least 7 days until he can go and put that right again. It's not like some sports where you're back on you know, the football pitch or the tennis court or the hockey or whatever a little bit sooner. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, sometimes it's 3 weeks before you go and participate once again. But he's found a release. He's found a way to keep excelling. He's found a way to cope with the pressure. And he is producing at the moment some of the greatest drives and some of the most dominant drives the sport of F1 has ever seen. I think he is one of our greatest athletes of all time, and not just in Formula One.
David, I would echo that sentiment, and I've been very vocal in my support of that theme accordingly. Stevenage's own, of course. But for some reason or other, he is a little bit Marmite, isn't he? He is a little bit divisive. I don't know if it is this kind of superstar lifestyle that he's earned the right to live or what have you. But I just feel that, quite frankly, he's successes. And again, he will be leveling up with Schumacher. I never thought anybody would get close to that in my lifetime, the record of seven. It's astonishing. I just feel as though he doesn't actually get enough support and appreciation from the British people, generally speaking. Again, like I say, I think there are two camps. Any take on that? Any reasoning behind why that might be so?
I think Lewis, and especially this year with the Black Lives Matters campaign, often forces us to think about things that we might not want to think about as a collective population. He wears his heart on his sleeve, sometimes appears sulky after a race if he hasn't won. Well, fine. If he's sulking after a race because he hasn't won, that's because he's disappointed in his own performance and he wants to put that right again. What's the phrase? Show me a good loser, I'll show you a loser. You know, Lewis Hamilton doesn't like losing. Is there anything wrong with that? No, there isn't. But people choose to use that as a criticism. People choose to use his stance on Black Lives Matter as a criticism. I don't understand why. Lewis is just saying, think about this. He's trying to raise awareness for a subject that the more you look into it, the more you think, well, we should be more aware as a society. Mm-hmm. If we are born as equal, why are we not treated equally? And you can't argue that in parts of the world, people are not treated equally and it needs to change. And Lewis is using his platform for social good. And I don't see anything wrong with that, but some people do. And you have to ask them why they find that uncomfortable and why they choose to criticize as a result of that. Do I just want to see my sportsmen and women just go out there and excel on the court and not have any moral obligation to be a role model? No, I don't. And I think the more Lewis has matured as a person, and let's not forget, you know, Lewis has been in Formula One since 2007. And, you know, that's a long time. And he has grown up a lot during that time and has realized that he can use his standing in society as a platform for change and a platform for a general conscience that he might not have thought about all those years ago. That to me is only a good thing. I don't know why people choose to criticize Tony. That is their right as a free human being to have that criticism. But think about why you're criticizing him. And if you're criticizing him because he lives a tax-free lifestyle in Monaco, well, then apply that same reasoning to every other person that lives in Monaco as well, that we seem to love as British sporting fans. And there are plenty of British sportsmen and women that live in Monaco. You know, and ask yourself this question: if you were in Lewis's shoes, would you do the same thing? And most of the time, you probably would. And don't think he doesn't pay taxes, because he does. Because he works for a British team, he races in Britain, he will pay a percentage of his salary in taxation as well. So it's not that he's contributing nothing. He is contributing something, but he chooses to live in Monaco. Why not? I would, wouldn't you?
Living the dream, and he's worked very hard indeed with his talents to achieve these great goals. And again, like I say, David, for me, equaling Schumacher, I genuinely thought that record of seven, I always think things are there to be broken. That's why we have these records, but I didn't see it happening anytime soon. I've got to ask you personally.
And it's not just breaking. It's not Tony just breaking those records. It's the fact that he will go on to establish new benchmarks, way above the benchmarks that Michael Schumacher set. Now, I'm not saying Michael Schumacher wasn't a great driver. He was, but Lewis has raised the bar. Just as you want to see your modern day athletes doing the same in other sports as well. I don't know when Lewis will quit. He hasn't got a contract for next year at the moment, but I don't think
there isn't it.
I don't think we won't see Lewis Hamilton on the track there.
Personal question for you though. Obviously, again, it still needs to be completed, although it's looking like a done deal this season. The seventh equaling, what's already happened though, of course, is he surpasses Schumacher for number of wins, now 93. Tell me about your privilege, I suppose, and your enjoyment as an F1 fan of getting to commentate on that record equaling and then record breaking victory for Hamilton.
Well, you know, it's really weird. It was only when we were in Portugal that I kind of sat down and had the realization that I've actually commentated on every single one of Lewis Hamilton's wins in Formula One. I started out in 2006 for Five Live. I missed one race, which was in 2007 at the Nürburgring European Grand Prix when my son was born, and Lewis didn't win that day. So maybe I'm a good omen. I don't know. I don't think that sort of thing applies. Just the same as I don't think the commentator's curse ever applies as well. I get a lot of times people say, "Oh, the commentator's curse, Crofty. That was all your fault." No, it's not. It's just one of those things. You make a prediction or you say something's happening, and then because it's live sport, it might just change around. But has it been a privilege? Yes. To watch Lewis's career ever since that first race in Australia. Before that, because in 06, we saw the potential of Lewis as a GP2 champion. And I'll never forget the Silverstone race that year. I'll never forget the Turkey race that year, where Lewis absolutely rubber-stamped what he could do in motorsport and what we could expect from him in years to come. But his first Formula One race, he went around the outside of Fernando Alonso at the first corner, and we suddenly thought, okay, here's the real deal. And he is the real deal, and he's a talent that comes along once in a generation. We're lucky that we've got Max Verstappen now in Formula One as well as that new talent, Charles Leclerc, coming through too, and people that will take the mantle to Lewis Hamilton over the years. But it has been an absolute pleasure to watch Lewis on the track and to see the way that Formula One has become popular in the UK from people that aren't necessarily F1 fans in the United States as well, through Lewis Hamilton, through Drive to Survive, which has also brought in brand new fans. But it does seem a strange one. And it makes me realise that I've been doing Formula One quite a long time as well, that I've been with Lewis throughout his career. And I suppose the strangest thing, you know, here I am, I'm a boy from Stevenage, he's a boy from Stevenage. We quite often talk about the fact that, you know, we've come from Stevenage to F1 and around the world, and, you know, he walks the walk and I talk the talk, to be fair on that one.
Well, I salute you both as great proponents of your particular skill sets.
Thank you.
I'm going to advocate the devil here, though, because, again, I'm on record. I'm a massive Lewis Hamilton fan. I certainly think he fits into category one of our all-time great sports stars, one of our great all-time human beings. I'm going to put it that far forwards. However, just to advocate the devil slightly, this dynasty now for Mercedes, a record 7 straight Constructors' Championships, surpassing Ferrari's 1994 record. For the casual fan, and let's not forget, F1, like all sports and like all businesses, is in the competition business, competing for eyeballs, competing for new fan base. How problematic do you think it is, not to take away from his successes by any means, but just to worry slightly about the bigger picture, that this has been such a phase of dominance for Mercedes?
Yeah, look, as you well know, darts is my other sport, and we've lived through the Phil Taylor era of dominance in darts, and that didn't dent the popularity of darts. It just forced others to raise their standards to eventually take Phil on and beat them. Our viewing figures at Sky F1 have shown an increase this year. So it's clear that the viewing public are not tiring of Mercedes dominance. And I think people phrase the question wrong. You know, is it bad for the sport? What can be done to stop Mercedes? Well, I don't think it's bad for the sport. Excellence is never bad for any sport. Mediocrity is bad for any sport, and I don't think we're seeing that. It is up to the others to raise their standards. It's not up to the sport to try and handicap Mercedes in any way. But we do see in Formula One regulation changes coming through from time to time, mainly to slow the cars down and to try and make the racing better and safer in equal measure, that offer an opportunity and a fresh start. Now, we get that in 2022. Mm-hmm. Who's to say Mercedes won't still dominate in 2022? I don't know, but it might be a little more equal. And maybe that there is a way to try and level up the playing field a little bit more. But we'll only see in 2022 whether that's necessary or not. For the time being, for me, when you've got a team so dominant and a driver so good, it should come as no surprise that they are at the top more often than not. There are, luckily, within Formula One, many other facets to enjoy. The fact that there's, what, 2 points, I think, as we stand between third, fourth and fifth at the moment, you know, it is a brilliant battle. Some of the great duels on track that we're seeing outside of the top two or three lend themselves to excitement on a race weekend. And people, you know, have the right to go and pick and choose their favourite drivers other than the ones that win all the time. So I think to answer your question, yes, you don't want to see people winning by a landslide every single week. But I don't think Mercedes are necessarily doing that, although sometimes you get that impression just looking at the results. Had Max Verstappen not had a puncture in the last race, Max Verstappen would have been, you know, second to Lewis Hamilton. Had the safety car not come out when it did, mm-hmm. Lewis Hamilton would have been that much closer to his teammate. In the end, he beats him by 25 seconds, but the factors contribute to that.
One amazing contributor to this era of dominance, of course, we've eulogized quite rightly about Lewis Hamilton, but it is a unique team designer, engineer fused sport. And that's its beauty. But talk to me a bit about the role of Toto Wolff in this and what his role might well be next year.
Well, I'll widen it out as well, because I don't think it's just Toto Wolff, although he, as the head of Mercedes-Benz Motorsport, has that overall responsibility for what happens to that F1 team. But I think you had a perfect alignment of the work that was done at Brixworth under Andy mm-hmm. Cowell for the engine side, producing the finest engine of the modern era, coupled with Toto's leadership qualities, allowing those on the chassis side at Brixworth to do their jobs. And for everyone to do their job without fear of failure, that to me is Toto Wolff's biggest skill as a manager, is empowering his staff, his engineers, his mechanics, you know, those that build, those that design spark plugs, to those that design suspension mm-hmm. parts, to those that, you know, build the car in the factory, to do their job without fear of failure. There is often the phrase in Formula One, we win as a team, we lose as a team. That is exactly how it's done at Mercedes. Fingers aren't pointed when something goes wrong at individuals. Conversations are had, mm-hmm. mistakes are learnt from, but the team moves on as one. Because in a sport, such a high pressurized sport as Formula One, failure is very easy. So to be able to do your job knowing that if you do get it wrong, you're not going to get singled out and your livelihood is not going to come under threat, mm-hmm. is a very fine way of going working. And I wish everyone could enjoy that same fearless way of doing their job, because it then empowers us to succeed as human beings. And that to me is Toto's legacy at Mercedes, that he has created a team that strive for the best. And when it does go wrong, they learn from it rather than point fingers in blame. Now, what his next role will be, I think he, as a shareholder of the team, he's not going anywhere. He said that he's earmarked someone already to take his role, but he won't say who, because that puts him under pressure. Once again, you know, that team ethos comes out. It's not about the individual. But he will take a more senior executive role, take a step back, not go to every race. You know, he's already proved he doesn't need to be mm-hmm. At every race, and just spend maybe a bit more time with his family or on other projects as well. He did want to replace Chase Carey as the man at the helm of the Formula One commercial rights holder. That was vetoed by Ferrari. That didn't come around. And I'm sure there are other projects that he wants to work on as well. He won't sit idle, but he won't be that day-to-day man in the factory that Mercedes have come to expect. What difference does that make? Didn't make much difference when Paddy Lowe left. Mm-hmm. It hasn't made a huge amount of difference now Aldo Costa has left. And these are just two senior members that have left that Mercedes team within the last few years. I'm not saying that they went and no one really missed them. Of course they missed them. They were excellent, excellent men. But there are other excellent people there to take their jobs. And that's the thing. It's a revolving door policy whereby if someone does leave, somebody else will come and replace them. And that should see the continuation of the Mercedes dynasty for a few more years to come.
Correct. And really appreciate your breaking down there of their culture that has led to continued success. Mm-hmm. David, you mentioned there another sport that you really are quality at providing commentary for and presenting live on. And it's not a million miles away now from the World Championships at darts. Are we going to be at the Ali Pali this year? And are we hoping for crowds, or is that a bit too naive at this stage, given our world context?
I'd like to give you the exclusive on that one, but I actually don't know the answer as yet. And I was only talking darts with our producer at Sky just a couple of days ago. There will be a world championship. As far as I'm aware, a venue has not been decided on. I don't think there'll be crowds. I think, to be honest, that wouldn't be the right example to set when other sports in the UK are being played behind closed doors. That changes the context totally of the World Championship and might offer up an opportunity for an outsider to be able to cope better with the play in the same way that Dimitri Van den Burr showed us at the World Match Play, 200-1 outsider that he went on and won the championship. Yeah, playing in front of 3,500 people stood behind you when you're on stage making it, and they're all making a lot of noise, is something that the pros have had to learn to deal with over the years, and I'm not sure I could deal with it. Although, to be fair, the only time I ever got to a darts final when I was younger, there was so much silence in the room as I was going for my doubles that it put me right off, and I swear that's why I actually lost. If they'd have carried on talking, I'd have been all right, but I just felt all the eyes on me. I completely bottled it. It was dreadful. But yes, we will have a world championship. I don't think there'll be a crowd there, but it will be shown every session on Sky, and fingers crossed I will be a part of it. But we don't finish the Formula One season until the 13th of December, so there's not going to be an awful lot of downtime. So I'm sure I'll be there in some way, shape or form.
Do you know what I love about the darts, though? Again, it is that kind of festive period. But it's essentially the first world champion of the year, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And Peter Snakebite Wright's obviously defending. And, you know, I was really pleased for him to get that. He's been a long time contender. Again, he's obviously lived under that era of Phil the Power Taylor, total dominancy. Will he go in as one of the favourites? Or like you say, do you think it's a very open tournament?
I think he will go in as one of the favourites. If he could actually settle on a set of darts to use for more than one match at a time, then he'd be an even bigger favourite in my book. When do you go back? 1993, first time Peter Wright made his debut at a world championship, off the top of my head, at the BDO World Championship at the Lakeside. There's a photo of him on the wall at the Lakeside. He hasn't got a Mohican. You barely recognise him. But yes, he'd be one of the favourites. Michael Van Gerwen's current form offers up a chance for anybody to see some initiative. Michael, at the start of 2020, moved to Winmore, changed his darts. And I'm not overly sure he settled on a set of darts that he's totally comfortable with. I also think he lacks a little motivation in some events because go back to the Lewis Hamilton thing, to keep winning, to keep that motivation at 100% is difficult when you're winning week in, week out. For Van Gerwen, probably even more difficult because he was winning sometimes day in, day out, not necessarily week in, week out. But he'll be highly motivated for the World Championship, make no mistake. But the fear of playing Van Gerwen, just the same as the fear of playing Phil Taylor towards the end of his career, has gone a little bit now. People know that he is vulnerable a touch on his doubles and that they can take advantage. And I've been massively impressed by Glenn Durrant, who has made the transition from the BDO as a three-time champion to the PDC brilliantly, and of course won the Premier League this year. Glenn Durrant is a scrapper and a half. You know, he's never beaten until you've hit that winning dart. And sometimes there are players that are beaten two sets out. Glenn Durrant is not one of those players. I really fancy Glenn Durrant for the world title this year. I think Gerwen Price has had an excellent year too, and I fancy his chances. Gary Anderson can always raise his game. Nathan Aspinall has been in the semi-finals twice on two occasions. His only two occasions at Ali Pali, and has to be a contender, especially given his work in the Premier League as well. And then there are lots of players below that are capable of a big win on the day, not necessarily winning a world title, but of a big scalp on the day. Personally, I'd love to see Dave Chisnell get through to at least the semi-finals, because Chizzy's got the game to be a world champion, came close against Martin Adams a few years ago, but has never got closer since. And we're already talking about a lot of contenders, and it's brilliant that there is a strength in depth in world darts at the moment, to the extent of which I don't think we've seen for many a long year. And that is its strength. We've seen Taylor domination, we've seen Van Gerwen domination, but underneath it, some absolutely sensational players. And there are players that need to perform big at Ali Pali because they're tumbling down the rankings as well. So that puts extra pressure on them when you're, as Bobby George used to say, playing for the rent. You don't want to play for the rent, Crofty. When you're playing for the rent, that's when you lose.
Again, the pressures of elite level sport is intense. I'm very grateful, as always, for your time. Just final quick question, though. We've been delighted to get your insights into real elite level sports there, and excited for Lewis, looking like he's going to claim his seventh. Excited already for the World Championships in darts. But it was great to see your role virtually this time round in kind of hosting and awarding out so many people in the Hertfordshire area in sports who've had to adapt and pivot. I understand, as we all do, this context of our world has put sport into its place. We have to respect that. But I would even argue that it even has an even more crucial role, perhaps, in mental and physical well-being. David, correct. Just remind us again of your appreciation for the role of local sport, both in Hertfordshire and, of course, across the country.
I'm a man who is fortunate enough to travel the world to not only watch and observe, but talk about the sports that I love, mainly Formula One. I've had a long career talking about sport, and I talk about sport mainly because I wasn't very good at playing it. I do play it a little bit, and I do, you know, still like to indulge a bit of cricket from time to time, or a bit of darts with my mates, and I go running quite often as well, because it's a sport that I can do. And I'm the same with golf. I play golf too, that I can do to fit around my schedule. But I talk about it because I wasn't great at playing it. There are So I go around the world doing that, but I never forget where I came from and where my formative years were spent. Mm-hmm. And that was in Stevenage, and it was in Hertfordshire. And I've never moved that far away. You know, I live in Bedfordshire still to this day. There are a huge amount of people for whom sport just wouldn't happen without the dedication and the unrelenting service to their sport that they provide day in, day out, in all weathers, at all times of the year, often for little or no rewards other than for being involved in the sport that they love. And I have been working now with the Heart Sports Partnership. It's got to be 10 years now. I presented, while they were going as well, the Comet Sports Awards in Stevenage. To try and keep touch with the community that gave me my inspiration and my platform to go and do what I've done now. I played village cricket, you know, I played school football, I played, you know, Saturday morning football. Signet Athletic, I used to play for in Stevenage, or Signet Nil, as I think that we were called by everybody else. But without the coaches, without the volunteers, I would never have had that chance. And without the volunteers, many thousands, mm-hmm. tens of thousands of people across Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire, Buckinghamshire, as is my old three counties patch, you know, wouldn't be able to do that either. So it's about just keeping that connection going and hearing the stories and helping to celebrate people's achievements. Because sport is a celebration. It will always be a celebration. And it is massively important in these times. We are in lockdown once again, but we can go out and exercise. So do go out and exercise. And that doesn't mean going for a 10-mile run. It doesn't mean pushing yourself, you know, to the bounds of exhaustion. It means just go for a walk somewhere. You know, just get out, enjoy the fresh air, see the community around you. Because when you get outside and you exercise, you take some time for the community as well, mm-hmm. and to appreciate the community that you live in. And when COVID has finally gone, because it will finally go and we will get rid of this, we can get back to enjoying more fully the sports that we love. And on a Saturday at 5 o'clock, I can once again have a deep frown on my face because West Ham have lost again, you know, and my kids can have a deep smile on their face because they can take the mickey out of dad because he's grumpy because West Ham have lost again. And that's just a little snapshot, yeah. of how sport brings a family together.
Brilliant stuff. Look, it's been a real pleasure to enjoy your company. Thank you for being with us for our 100th Verulam Sport Podcast episode. Enjoy the Turkish Grand Prix. Keep well, keep safe. And thanks once again, David. Hello, and again, welcome to a very special 100th episode of Verulam Sports Podcasting. And we've got yet another very special guest with us now. It is John McKenna, co-founder and CEO of Noah Media Group, the award-winning Noah Media Group, I should say, famed for great documentaries such as The Edge, Bobby Robson, More Than a Game, and a whole array of others. Check their back catalogue out, some amazing stuff, but something amazing coming up for us to enjoy very soon. I'm excited to build up to it tonight with John McKenna. John, welcome back to Verum Sports. How are you?
I'm fine, Tony, thanks. It's good to see you.
Hey, always a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to building up to your most recent project, which I think is available towards the end of this month for us to access, DVD and download. But just for a second, John, before we get down to business, got to ask you, how do you assess Everton's start to the season? Obviously, two straight defeats, but starting now in fourth place in the Premier League, that's the giddy heights, John. That's the giddy heights.
Oh, it was going so well, wasn't it? And then, very good, thanks, Tony. Yes, the mighty Blues is my long-suffering burden. I've managed to make my three St Albans boys Evertonians, which is my finest achievement in life, the poor little men. And, we started magnificently, but we haven't got a squad that's big enough to cope with injuries and suspension.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you what, those twin demons is something that manager that is going to be put under the microscope now and really drilled into with your wonderful documentary. Jack Tolleton knew how to manage and maximise the best of his squads, didn't he? And your new documentary, Finding Jack Charlton, I'm very excited to learn a bit more about it. One of the game's great characters, John, you'll know that better than I do. But tell us just a little bit about how this project came to be. And a little bit of a tease about what we can expect in this.
Yeah, sure. So Finding Jack Charlton is the documentary, as you say. And it's been a film that's been quite a while in the making because of several factors, really. We started, as you know, and as I've mentioned here before, Noah Media Group is the company that I run and we make the documentaries. And Gabriel Clark is a co-founder with me. And he's a co-director on this, along with Pete Thomas, who works for us as well. Gabriel read about Jack and Jack's influence of Jack and Jack's team on Irish history. He read a few articles and pieces on that, which led to a conversation with Andy Townsend. And Gabriel and I both, well, Gabriel still does work for ITV. I used to work for ITV Sport. We both know Andy. From those days, Gabriel had a chat with Andy, who was obviously Jack Charlton's captain for a period of his reign as manager, and mentioned this. We did research on documentaries that had been made about Jack, and it felt like no one had really. There'd been TV documentaries, but no one had done a film documentary about Jack, and so it led to a meeting with Andy and the family. And we agreed to go and make this film with them. So the usual challenges of raising funding, assessing whether we thought it was a big enough audience for it. With Jack being both an English hero and an Irish legend, we thought, well, we've got a good chance here. And to be honest with you, Tony, when we started off, there's a couple of really good stories, one about the archive and then one about some notes that we found. But at that point in time, we envisaged this as being a story about the crack, the Irish team, behind the scenes archive. And we were thinking we would look to release it around Euro 2020 if Ireland got there. As it transpires, neither Euro 2020 happened and nor have Ireland actually got to Euro 2021. But that was the initial thinking, similar to when we released Bobby around the World Cup. We'd release this around the European Championships. And then a few things happened, really. We found incredible archive, including behind-the-scenes stuff with Jack that was remarkably shot by Craig Johnston, who used to play for Liverpool in the 80s. He was filming with the Ireland team throughout Italia 90, and the tapes were in a wardrobe in Sydney and never been seen since. So we managed to get hold of them, which was great. And the stuff captured there is amazing. Amazing. Do you know what? Never be seen for really
Shades
intimate moments.
Of the, another bit of your award-winning work with the
Steve McQueen and the
archive.
That's
the one. Yeah, absolutely. It seems you've got a magic touch with finding these rare archive pieces.
It's nothing to do with me, but we were aware that this stuff existed, because when we did the Bobby Robson film, we found out about Craig and being part of this scenario where he was filming with a load of teams at Italia 90. And so we contacted him hoping he'd film with the England team, and he hadn't. And he said, but I did film with the Ireland team at the time. So we knew this existed. And so we went and Pete went over to Sydney to track him down and get it. And his mission was, don't come back without it. And he didn't. He came back with it. And it was amazing. There's one tape which is in the film, which is after Ireland have gone out. And obviously they're all really disappointed, and they go back to the hotel, and it's 30-minute tape as it was in those days, and they film and they stop, and at the start it's nighttime around a cobbled fountain, and they're all singing songs around this fountain, and by the end it's daylight, so that shows how late into the night it went. It was into the morning. And it's amazing. It's like, it's you know, the scene in the film. It was one of those tapes that you put in and you watch it. Or you put on now. You don't put into a player anymore. And it's like, for the first 5 minutes, you're thinking, this is 10 out of 10. And by the end of it, you're like, how high can I go in terms of my grading? Yeah. Chris de Burgh was sitting around the fountain. He sings Hey Jude, but changes it to Hey Jack, and everyone sings along. Jack sings Blade and Races, which is a really big part of the film. Because we'll talk about what Jack was going through as well at the time. It's amazing. So we knew we had that. Then we went up to start filming with Jack. And then we realised, or Gabriel and Pete realised, that, well, actually, Jack had dementia. And we didn't really, we'd heard that might be the case, but we didn't realise the extent of it. And so as the filming progressed, the family were open to us coming and documenting this honestly and respectfully. And Jack engaged on days with the camera and was very aware of what was going on at times. And then obviously at other times with the condition, he wasn't. But we started to get this modern material, and then it became quite apparent that this was changing what the film could be, and actually, with a duty of making it the best film it can be, what the film should be. And so the film became a different film to what we set out about. It was no longer the joy of the Guinness drinking, you know, camaraderie. That's full and part of the film, but it was actually also about the final, you know, if you like, the three chapters of Jack's life, life are in the film. The England amazing World Cup win and conquered the world, the man who transformed the nation as manager, and then the guy who's in a way facing his biggest challenge in the final act of his life. And so that was where the film was going. Then COVID happened and we couldn't film, so we had to put the film into pause. And then we were still all sort of in semi-lockdown, but we were able to film again. And you know, from a company point of view, we'd put the vast majority of the resources into the film, and it wasn't far from being finished filming. And then we could still edit, so we just need to finish the filming. And then so we went back up to film with Jack in the summer when we could, and then it became clear that he was really not very well, and then unfortunately passed away about a week after we picked up filming with him. So then he obviously, Jack's passing, it is part of the time frame of the film. So the whole thing became it became much bigger than what we anticipated. I suppose that's the backstory of the film to where we are now. And the film is released this month. Jack is, it's called Finding Jack Charlton because, my dog's barking in the
background. It's okay.
It was called Finding Jack Charlton because we were trying to get to the heart of who Jack was. He was a complicated man.
Yes.
He was determined. He was belligerent. He rubbed some people the wrong way, but he didn't care. And he was brilliant. And he was warm. And he was loyal. And he looked after people. And all of that is part of how we try and get to the real Jack. And also, it's a film about memories and celebrating memories. While Jack, unfortunately, was losing his memory at the end of his life.
So, so powerful. Massive, massive themes. And it sounds to me that as always, the goal is to create an honest homage to the full picture of a very impressive character. always there. What's important, it strikes me, is that it's great that you have this gift of unearthing fabulous archive footage. But I think the key is that you get really strong buy-in here from the family. Without that, I would imagine it would be nigh on impossible to get the full 360, which is so important, that comes through here. Just talk to me about how important Pat Kemp, his widow, is and has been to this film.
Yeah, the family were obviously crucial. And, you know, that was the first meeting that was had by Gabriel and Andy, went and met Pat and went and met John, who is Jack's son, mm-hmm. and lives very close to his mum and sort of doesn't look after his mum, but is with her a lot. You know, they're very close, and they are the sort of the family with Jack, were with Jack. And so, yeah, we wanted to, I mean, we always want to, it's always an independent film that we make, and, you know, you can't make a film that the family decide the film you're going to make, because otherwise it's too rose tinted. It's not true. And, you know, Jack, there are some criticisms of Jack in the film, but we want it to be fair. We want it to be balanced, because then I think the true character will come through, and there's so much good outweighing what some people would say is the bad. Although part of that bad is what made him such a successful individual, that I think hope in the long term, when the film is seen, the family see it, they love it, and they're supportive, which is the case, which is fantastic. Yeah, the family were crucial for their contribution to the film, obviously, for the trust that they gave to Pete and to Gabriel to allow them to film really tough times, and the trust that they put in us to handle that appropriately, sensitively, which I believe and hope we have. And then when you get that trust, then it hopefully makes the film better, obviously, but it also always gives you the opportunity to get more than you think. And we got that both in the scenes we were able to get with the family at home, and Jack, the lots of scenes with him and his grandchildren in his final months of his life, which are very emotional, and also then what we managed to find, which is a big theme in the film, is it was a chance conversation in the middle of production between Pete Thomas, the co-director, and Pat, in which Pete just said, "Listen, is there anything else you've got that we don't know about?" And Pat pulled out these big padded envelopes full of notes that Jack had kept throughout his career, and he was a really, really brilliant after dinner speaker after he finished management. And whenever he went and did them, he'd make notes and get all his thoughts down on management and players, and kept them all and wrote them on the back of napkins or menus, but they were all there. There was hundreds of them. And so gave them to Pete and Gabe, and they went through them all. And all of a sudden it was like, this is, you know, it again allowed that sort of a juxtaposition of the fading memories of the man, and his memories written down for all to remember. And so we were able to use his thoughts in his own handwriting, and they've become quite a big part of the film. The inner thoughts of Jack's mind when he was still lucid, you know.
And again, what a mind it was. You know, a great player, a great manager, a great motivator. Again, you're aware that there are, of course, with all humans, flaws. But I think sometimes when people hear the name Jack Charlton, maybe similarly to his brother, they think of him as a great manager. But he was a rather good player. In fact, in 67, I think he earned FWA Footballer of the Year, actually kind of second consecutive year for Family Charlton, I think, for that honour. And I believe that it was that night that maybe on a bigger scale, that gift that he had for after-dinner speaking and anecdotal communication came to the fore. So just, again, of course, we can't forget his World Cup efforts. But just your take from this study of him, of his role as actually a football player.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, you're not going to be a World Cup winner and be anything but a brilliant player, but I think he was, I mean, our film is actually structured around his managerial tenure as Irish managers, but we do obviously go and then tell the story of him as a player. But in his own, I think his own assessment of his own ability was he knew he had certain strengths and he was very good at them. In the film, he says, "I was a destroyer. I was a batterer." You know, he mentions it in the film. He had a little black book with certain names on them, and
a lot of controversy, that particular black book, didn't it?
Yeah. And if he came against those players, he was gonna leave his mark on them. He was the later developer. Bobby Charlton was always going to play for England.
Yeah,
and Jack wasn't, but Jack worked at it, and I think that's the essence of what Jack was as a man. It was what he was as a player, and it's what he was as a man. He had to earn it. You know, it wasn't a natural gift for him. You know, he left school and went down the mines, and then before he became a footballer. And I think that working class work ethic, you don't get anything unless you really apply yourself to it. I think that's what made him the player he was. I think he probably forced his way to the top rather than was always on a pathway there.
Another great documentary that you did, again, with kind of family support, almost to a degree setting the record straight, was the great study of Brian Clough. And character-wise, I think whilst they are kind of worlds apart, they have that same kind of from the Northeast kind of working class ethic. And the reason I brought that up is because I thought it was a brilliant quote actually from Andy Townsend, almost as a kind of a summation of Jack Charlton. He said, "Be a dictator, but a nice one." Where does that kind of dichotomy fit in your study of Jack?
Well, I mean, that was Andy reading one of Jack's notes. So that was Jack's assessment of himself, or Jack's sort of instruction to himself.
Yeah.
I think that Jack was, he was able to be a nice dictator because of that character he had, I suppose, which is he didn't care what people thought of him. And so he was able to say what he thought and be in a way bullish about it. But he was also fiercely loyal.
Yeah.
And he was also, so if you were in, if you worked hard and if you showed the right traits and if you were the right type of person, then he'd be nice to you as well and he'd look after you. And it's, I mean, in the film, one of the big narrative arcs of the film, there's him the player, there's him the manager, there's Jack and dementia, there's Jack and Bobby. It's a very complicated structure that Gabriel especially has put together with Pete. And it's weaved together beautifully. But one of the big storylines that we keep revisiting is Jack and Paul McGrath.
Yes.
And Paul and his battles. And Paul was battling alcoholism throughout his playing career. And Jack knew that. And it impacted Paul's playing career, but Jack looked after him. Mm-hmm. And you know, if there's one element in the film that shows the be a nice one, be a nice one doesn't do it justice really to what he how he looked after Paul. And Paul, without giving the film away, will obviously reflect on that honestly and emotionally as well. I think it's interesting you talk about Clough, Brian Clough, because, they're very similar characters, I would say, probably. They would say how it was. Mm. They didn't care. They had huge self-belief. And they were, I think possibly the difference, and maybe something that our film will hopefully make people think more about, is I think Clough is acknowledged as a managerial genius.
Yeah.
Obviously a European Cup winning managerial genius. But I don't think Jack has ever been acknowledged as a brilliant manager. And I think what the film shows is actually man management, and some of the players argue tactically.
Yeah.
He was at the very top.
You're dead right. I mean, goodness me, that 1990 World Cup in Italy was Ireland's first ever appearance at a World Cup. And then there was European Championships 94. I want to talk to you about that in just a second. But what he achieved in kind of that context with relatively limited resources is truly astonishing. And, you know, again, making new ground for the country. So he was so well loved, wasn't he, by Ireland? You know, I think he actually became an honorary Irish citizen, which is pretty much the highest honor that they can bestow. But one thing that I'm really interested about, because you always weave together these wonderful themes, John, but again, you do it always, I find, brilliantly with kind of the context and the sociological context of that time when he took over the helm, I think in 85, an Englishman managing Ireland in that climate must have been very, very challenging. And for him to kind of have the strength of character to oversee that, to then almost become literally embraced by all of Ireland. Just talk to me a little bit about that. And again, that as a, I guess, a measure of the man.
100%. I mean, he was, to, for an Englishman to be appointed an Irish manager at the, probably what was the height of the Troubles, or certainly very, very much in the middle of the Troubles, was a pretty extraordinary appointment, a pretty extraordinary acceptance of an appointment, and wasn't particularly embraced by a lot of the country and a lot of the players. And yeah, he turned it around. And as you say, he was made an honorary Irish citizen. And I think other people that have been given that are Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, you know, that level of person. And
it's not bad company, is it?
Not bad company. And yeah, he did it with his honesty, his hard work, and obviously the success he brought. He gave the people of Ireland, and a lot of people in the film, we got, like, it's not just sport people in the film. There's Roddy Doyle, the author. There's Larry Mullen Jr., the U2 drummer, and politicians, Bertie Ahern. They talk about how he, you know, that at that point in time, the economy was on the floor.
Yeah.
Immigration was people were just flooding out of the country. And their words in the film, and not mine, are that there was not an awful lot to hang on to if you were Irish at that point in time. And what Jack did with that team gave people hope, gave people belief, and made people proud to be Irish again. And there's an amazing quote in the archive by Mary Robinson, who became the president. And she became the first woman Premier of Ireland. And in her acceptance speech, or in the piece of archive we've sourced, she talks about bringing something back to Ireland that she first saw in the way the country acted around Italia 90. Yeah. And so, you know, what that team and Jack's team brought to that country was, you don't want to overstate it. You know, it was a peace process where Jack Charlton was not part of the actual peace process. Of course he wasn't. But what he and his team brought to that country, as explained by people who were there experiencing it in the film, it's incredible.
And this is why sport, and I think documentaries on sport, are so important, because they remind us, don't they, of how it elevates. It gives us a sense of identity, of cohesion. And, you know, again, it is the characters here, Jack Charlton, who kind of drive that forwards. But so many great memories, John. It must have been challenging to go from these moments where he is a hero of a nation towards the end of his life. I think it's vital that you don't shy away from showing that. But the challenges of dementia, again, I know it's not necessarily the overarching aim, but do you think an offshoot of this could well be that it will raise awareness of dementia and maybe become people's understanding of that horrible condition?
I mean, obviously, that would be incredible. I mean, we've partnered with two charities in the film. So we partnered with Alzheimer's UK and Alzheimer's Ireland. And they are, you know, they're really, really supportive of the film. And I think it's going to really be great for the conversations around the condition. I think already with the reaction, it's very interesting because we were supposed to be obviously in cinemas tomorrow, but that's not possible due to lockdown. But so a lot of the early pieces have started to come out in the papers around the film, and that's just really the part of the film that a lot of people have started the conversation about, and it's led to big pieces and big articles about dementia, and it was revealed obviously over the weekend that Bobby Charlton is also suffering from dementia, and that actually came from the film, because that was the Telegraph piece came about because the Telegraph journalist had watched the film and so contacted us, and then everyone was put together. So so that conversation has come from the film. Everything obviously that's been talked about around Jack's dementia because of the access the family were incredibly generous to give us for the film. That's the reason, you know, we wanted to film was to try and make something that that handles this sensitively, and that those that have been through this illness, you know, with people that they love and care for, will appreciate it's been handled correctly, and it will allow conversations to hopefully start off the back of it. And you know, already I think that there's an interesting conversation, which I think the film is part of. I'm not saying it started it.
Sure.
With obviously Bobby. The news about Bobby, the news about Nobby Styles passing away last week. Jack now, it's now clearly in the public domain with this film, especially that he had dementia in his final days. I think a conversation that's much bigger than the film will be happening, but hopefully we can be a part of that. Yeah.
And again, that is sort of one of the trademarks or signatures of the kind of NOAA Media Group. I find it fascinating that it doesn't necessarily be something that you have an express intention to do, but the kind of stories that you tell do hit upon this. The Edge, for instance, did wonderful things to make, I think, people more conscious of the pressures of sport. And then a bigger debate out of that is the pressures of depression. So it is, I think, a massive credit to you and team that you are able to add something more to the zeitgeist and the collective consciousness than just a very simple linear story. So it seems, I don't know, John, not necessarily by design, but certainly by end goal, one of the great gifts that you're giving to the world.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about gifts, but I mean, you know, Gabriel, I mention him a lot in these conversations, and you know, there's a huge credit needs to go to him. And, you know, he's made this film with Pete. He was involved in The Edge, which Barney Douglas directed. You know, the Bobby Robson film before that, which was obviously a film about a man who was much bigger than the game, and you know, the battles he had with cancer and the incredible foundation he started. I think whenever we try and make these films, and Gabriel really is the guy that structures these structures so well, you know, so well, usually to about five times the length that the film needs to be, which is the big challenge, 90 minutes. But whenever we set out to make these films, we'll only commit to these subjects if we think there's multiple layers that we can get to. And so where that ultimately leads you, you never know when you start. But I think, you know, we knew with The Edge that there was an amazing archive that would allow us to get inside cricket like never before. And the fact that led to mental health was because of the honesty and openness of the players. And then with Jack, we knew he was a very complex man. And we knew going in there that we were going to try and break down who this guy was, you know, and try and get that. And we knew that there was the whole Irish social transformation argument. Yep. So we knew plenty of elements in there. And so it might have been without what, if Jack was healthy and still with us, the film would be a different film. I think that's probably the biggest, I don't know, you call it a challenge or you call it the joy of documentary making, is that once you start, you've got to follow what that story is. And it's journalism. You'll know it's following the story. And Gabriel's a journalist, and we'll follow the story, and we'll not ask a set. He'll have a set load of questions he wants to go down in any interview he does, but actually if someone then takes him down a different path, he'll go with it. And that's what both The Edge and Jack have led to, is that type of journey where you suddenly think, whoa, hold on a minute, actually this is bigger than we thought. And that's great.
I'm already very excited to get this into my world. I'm looking forward to it. Final quick question though, just about the aesthetic of your art form. Because again, we've discussed about the characters, the different strands, the bigger issues that can come through anchored with the centerpiece. Music, though, is always very, very important. It kind of adds, creates the mood sometimes, amplifies the mood. I know an awful lot of hard work went in with, I think, the Maccabees from The Edge, for instance. Talk to me just a little bit about the music aspect of the upcoming Finding Jack Charlton.
So there's a guy who I've worked with since, oh, blimey, too long, who's a composer by the name of Jim Copperthwaite, who is a great bloke. He did the music on Bobby. He did the music on the Steve McQueen film. He did the music on Clough. So I've worked with him for years and years and years. And Jim is the original composer on this. And so it's pretty much all Jim's original music. But there's two exceptions to that. Well, there's three exceptions to it, actually, which is music in and around Jim. So Jim's done an amazing job, and it sets the tone and the mood, and the, especially when you don't want to try and tell people what to think when they're watching a scene. So there's a very fine balance to his art form. And I would call that an art form because it's amazing to watch him work. And but this time there's three other bits of music around this which I think are really, really significant in the film. One is I mentioned already, which is, it's not a big moment in the a long moment in the film, but it's a big moment in the film, which is when the players are singing around the fountain. From Niall Quinn singing an Irish folk song with his eyes closed through to remarkably Chris de Burgh singing Hey Jack to the tune of Hey Jude.
Who knew?
As you do. that's an amazing scene. Then there's two other moments. So Jim recommended a track by a Dublin band called Lancome, singing Wild Rover, which is obviously a very traditional Irish song, but they sing this unbelievably emotive version of it. Sorry, my dog's going again.
It's okay. Nearly feeding time, I'd imagine.
Yeah. And that we use that in the biggest moment in football moment, sporting moment in the film, which is the Ireland-Romania penalty shootout in the World Cup 90. And that scene is built around the drama of that football-wise, Jack fishing with his son, and this music, which is just incredible. And there's audio from Jack on Desert Island Discs in that, where he talks about what the Irish people thought of him. Mm-hmm. And so that scene, I think, is genuinely as good a scene as there's been in any of our films so far. And then the last bit of music that's worth mentioning this is, I mentioned around the fountain that that Jax is singing, and Jax sings Blade and Races, which is a Northeast traditional song. And obviously, you know that dementia makes people lose their memories, and people say that music sometimes cuts through on that. And so, Pete, co-director, had an idea, and so we knew we had Blade and Races in the film. And so we took went up to the Northeast, and it's the final scene of the film.
Yeah.
Goodness me, my dog. Final scene of the film is. Sorry, Tony.
It's okay. No worries, John.
And the final scene of the film is we get have a record player in the, up there, and we play Blade and Races to Jack, and what happens is just magic.
I tell you what, I'm already excited. Everything that you've ever touched so far has been magical. Honestly, mean that passionately. Can you tell us again, it's coming out end of November. We can only wait with anticipation for getting access to it at the cinemas, but we can get this in our world through downloads and also via DVD. Tell us a bit more about how we can achieve that exciting goal.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's out 23rd of November. It's out on download, on a DVD, iTunes, Apple, Sky Store. You can buy it from the 23rd of November. And then after that, when we're able to, we'll be looking to get it still into cinemas as well, including hopefully The Odyssey in St. Albans, mm-hmm. which last three of our films have been in. So fingers crossed we can make that happen. So yeah, it's available for towards the end of November for Christmas and then in the new year in sort of March time, it'll be BBC Two and Virgin Media in Ireland. So it'll be then off and on its life around the TV. But 23rd of November, it's available. It was supposed to be cinemas this week, but that'll come slightly later.
Hey, we'll look forward to it. Once again, though, 23rd of November, just a few weeks away. Just remind us of the different sources that we can access finding Jack Charlton.
Yeah, so DVD or Blu-ray and all the major supermarkets are really behind it. So it should be in all of them, which is amazing. Download, iTunes, wherever you download your films, it will be available in everywhere you'd expect it to be.
Perfect. John, listen, I'm excited to watch this. I always appreciate your work. I always value your time. Thank you once again, and keep well, keep safe in these challenging times. Hello, and welcome to a very special 100th episode of Verulam Sport Podcasting. And we've worked quite hard. We've assembled a galaxy of stars, and one of those is a real superstar. Actor, writer, broadcaster, there seems to be no end to this man's talents. And it's a pleasure to welcome to Verulam Sports, Tom Watt. How are you, Tom?
I'm all right, mate. I'm all right. I don't know about the big build-up, though, blimey. No end to his talents. More like no start to his talents, to be honest. That's why I have to have so many things I do, because I'm not very good at any of them. So,
well, look, I'll tell you what. It is nevertheless an impressive life that you've led, Tom, I think. And one thing that's really come through to me is that you've really kind of taken it by the horns. Was it always clear to you that you're going to be a performer of some type?
Well, no. What was always clear to me was I was going to be an actor. That was always from when I was a kid. I was absolutely, I did the whole kind of school plays and all that business, and went and did a degree at university, degree in drama. And then started my own theatre company, ran that for 3 or 4 years, and then, started freelancing as an actor and ended up in EastEnders sort of thing. So that was always going to happen. And all the other stuff has not happened by accident exactly, but opportunities have presented themselves. And I thought, yeah, I quite fancy that. You have an idea for a book, or someone asks you to go on the radio, or, someone says, what about this TV documentary? And you kind of, I always thought, well, I'm not going to turn these things down, because I think of myself just as an actor, and I've always loved football. So a lot of it was to do with football anyway. So yeah, whether it's, writing a book about the Arsenal, or doing, documentaries about football for BT Sport or whoever, if it's football, I'll kind of, particularly if I've never done, if it's something I've never done before, I'll just say yes, sight unseen.
Well, again, honestly, the amount of opportunities that you have either created, willed, or just seized is astonishing. I'm looking forward to unpacking it. But let's, not necessarily the starts, but let's get back to maybe the acting role. So I suppose for many, Tom, you're always going to be firmly associated with the role of Lofty Holloway in EastEnders, one of the original cast members way back in 1985. I guess you can't really, but was there some kind of sense that this was going to become such a phenomenon?
No, not really. Although once it got to air, it got very popular very quickly. And I've got to say that all those other opportunities, I think a very large proportion of them, certainly early on, came because of that. Do you know what I mean? It's a slightly kind of unfortunate thing, but I do think sort of having, if people know your name, you have a better chance of getting some in a way. And certainly people come and ask you to do things that perhaps if it was your idea and you were trying to make it happen, wouldn't necessarily happen. So it was a great experience in and of itself. I mean, it was brilliant, really had a great time doing EastEnders, although after 3 years I'd had about enough. But it was a fantastic experience. Worked with some really good people, particularly really good writers, mm-hmm. And good directors and what have you. And, you know, that did sort of kick off a lot of other things, a lot of other opportunities. So, you say people will associate you with. I mean, I'm more than happy with that, because it was really a thing that kind of cracked open the door for me.
And again, you've now opened that and taken it to many different stratospheres, and we'll unpack it. But just talk to me a little bit about the acting challenges of being in a soap. As you say, you did the role for 3 years, 85 to 88, and then returning again in 2019 for a reappraisal. But it must be challenging because, you know, it's constant, isn't it? So obviously,
yeah, although, to be honest, Tony, it's not as... I don't think it was as challenging for us as it is for the cast now.
Yeah.
You know, they're having to turn out twice as much television a week as we were. You know, we were just two episodes a week, two episodes and a compilation on a Sunday. So yes, it's quite relentless, but you know, we had time to rehearse.
Sure.
We had time, you know, time to kind of learn lines and time to, yeah, just time to kind of breathe with it, really. Where I did, as you say, I went back in to do one episode just for sort of old time's sake, really. When was that? Yeah, 2019. I've recorded it, and I went back in, and you know, you see how hard they work now, and how kind of the schedule now is really that they graft these days. You know what I mean? In a way that I don't think, you know, we try to work as hard as we could, and certainly everybody involved sort of did the best job they could. And yes, relative to other jobs, it was still a quick turnaround, you know, a day's rehearsal maybe, and then turning out an hour of television. But even so, or 2.5 hours of television, but even so, compared to what they're doing now, it wasn't, you know, we had a bit of room to breathe, sort of thing.
I really appreciate your perspective there, but again, I'd still say a massive challenge. And again, because it's such a embraced show, isn't it? You know, you just become a part of people's lives. It must be quite challenging accordingly. Want to just get your final question on EastEnders before we move forwards.
Yeah.
How exciting was it, Tom, when you got the final line or the final scene before that famous kind of dum 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 dum, 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 dum moment?
I can't say it was ever any kind of big deal for me, to be perfectly honest. I think that, you know, what you've got to remember with soap operas is that for all that there were kind of, the EastEnders did make, as it were, one or two stars, particularly Leslie Grantham and Anita Dobson, you know, Den and Ange. Although it did make one or two stars, the thing about soap operas is they are absolutely ensemble pieces. They're not like a play. They're not like a lead in a film or something. You know, they're very, you know, you're talking about at any one time, probably 15, 20 regular characters, all of whom have a part to play in shaping the whole thing together, mm-hmm. sort of thing. So I never really saw it as a kind of, I've got a big bit in this week. Or look, all I do know is that because, for various reasons, I ended up playing a really, really good character.
Yeah.
I mean, from an acting point of view, it was a really good character because it was a character that could carry comic storylines, but he was also a character that could carry serious storylines. And I actually was ready to leave probably before I did. And, I remember the conversation with Julia Smith and her just saying, look, we think this character's got some distance to travel yet. Why don't you stop for a while and we'll cram it all in? So I did get particularly the second and third years I was in EastEnders, I did get a lot of really good stuff to do. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Now, whether, before the drum beats come in or not, it never really kind of particularly occurred to me because, of course, it's not recorded in that order anyway. You know, it's not recorded in chronological order, so you're not really sort of, yeah, obviously the script is written in chronological order, but you're not particularly aware of it. So it was that was never a particularly big deal.
Got you. Well, I tell you what, I appreciate there the kind of pathos and the bathos of the lofty character. And I guess as an Arsenal fan, you've experienced a little bit of those two extremes through your time as a fan. Just want to talk to you a little bit about Arsenal in a moment. But as a Gunner, how exciting was it to put on the one-man stage version of Nick Hornby's seminal classic Fever Pitch, which of course recounts the story, memoir style of a man's memories, really, as they connect to life, society, and his football team, which is the Gunners. Talk to me a little bit about that one-man stage version of Fever Pitch.
Yeah, that was... Yeah, that was one of the great jobs, actually. I've got us to it. I mean, I was, I knew Nick Hornby around that time, around the time of Fever Pitch and just after. You know, we were both a little bit involved with the fanzine movement, you know, writing for fanzines and stuff. And I think we both contributed chapters to a book about Arsenal. And do you know what I mean? There was and then my first book about Arsenal, Nick was one of the people that I spoke to because it was a kind of oral history of the North Bank. So I wanted different perspectives. And obviously, you know, Nick had a very sort of articulate and different perspective on supporting Arsenal and specifically supporting Arsenal from the North Bank. So that was all good. Obviously enjoyed the book massively. The book was really important for anybody who was writing about football around those times, because suddenly publishers thought, oh, hang on, actually there's quite a lot of people out there who do want to read about football. So it suddenly made it possible for, I think, quite a lot of people to publish books which had a football connection. I don't mean imitations of Fever Pitch, but books that had some kind of football connection. It became the sort of subject that was more readily written about. And then it was sometime later, it was right around the time the film came out, actually, sort of about six or eight months before the film came out. And I just got approached, and the stage version, unlike the film, which obviously Nick wrote the screenplay for the film, which I did get an audition for, funny enough, but didn't get the part, not to play him, obviously, but to play another character in it. But the film obviously was sort of reimagined for the screen. Mm-hmm. So it was rewritten and, you know, was different in some, maybe you could say many respects from the book. The stage play, the guy who'd done it had really, all he'd done was he'd taken Chunk, because Fever Pitch is written in the first person, and this was a one-person show, basically he'd just taken chunks from the book and put them together, which was, you know, I mean, maybe that tells you why, one of the reasons why the book was so successful, that you could even do that, that you could actually, the words that were there on the page, you could speak them and it genuinely sounded like a football fan talking. You know what I mean?
Really,
that's something to catch.
It has the feel of a cult classic, but it's got such mass appeal. As you say, there's at least two movie versions of it now. But again, it's the honesty, isn't it? I think whatever you do, if you're authentic and you really kind of find that voice, things fall into place.
Yeah, I think there's quite a bit more to it than that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, yeah, that's important, but you need to be able to write, and Nick Hornby really can write. Do you know what I mean? So that stage play was a one-man show. It was a bit of a kind of dream job, really. Mm-hmm. And what was great, because obviously you have to kind of, you know, you have to take the audience, a live audience, on this journey, and you're going, you know, different games and different situations. And of course, every game that's mentioned, I've been at that game.
Yeah.
Because I've been watching Arsenal that long. Do you know what I mean? So there was no game. The only difference was that instead of watching 26th of May 1989 on TV, I was at Anfield that night. That's the only difference. All the other games that Nick talked about in Fever Pitch, I was at those games. So that helped. It was almost like I'd spent my life doing the research for that play. Do you know what I mean? It was really, really good. Unfortunately, we did have to kind of stop doing it. When the film came out, they kind of withdrew the rights to the stage play, I guess, understandably. I think it has been done again since. I don't know, but I think it has. I think the play has been, one-man play has been done again since. But it was really cleverly done. The guy who'd adapted it had just used Nick's own words, and just, you know, it was yeah, it was a great job.
A great experience there. But interesting experiences you must have had there, as you rightly say, a lifetime fan of Arsenal. Again, that's memories of that famous 88-89 season. Michael Thomas getting the goal that provided a 2-0 victory to ensure Arsenal were champions. You've, of course, witnessed subsequently the Arsene Wenger era and the unbeatables and all that. Got to ask you now, in this current era of Arsenal, an important victory at the weekend against Manchester United. How do you assess Mikel Arteta, and do you think he is the right man to move things forward for Arsenal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have all sorts of concerns about sort of where the club's headed as an organisation, as a football club. I'm not quite sure what the... But Arteta is obviously, you know, is obviously an exceptional coach. And, you know, won an FA Cup semi-final against Man City and then beat Chelsea in a cup final within months of taking over with a group of players who really had lost their way and who by and large are not at the level of kind of previously successful Arsenal teams. I think, you know, it's great credit to Arteta. Because I really think he's... And to be fair, it's great credit to the players as well, because they have responded. Do you know what I mean? But that's, you know, that's very much about Arteta having ideas, having a plan and being able to communicate them properly.
And of course, he's come from that kind of Gunners perspective. He does understand the club and what that represents. So we'll see how his tenure continues to develop.
Yeah, obviously, when he was at Arsenal, it was a very different club. Different ownership, different, you know, that everything about the club was different when he was here as a player. But and I think that's what he connects with. He connects back to values and, you know, values and traditions and standards, which are historical for the most part, rather than current. Do you know what I mean? So he kind of brings that back. It's almost like reconnecting with what Arsenal's been about historically, and he's got a really good, and obviously, you know, people like Per Mertesacker and Edu probably have that as well, but have that kind of sense of what Arsenal's always stood for.
Absolutely, and we'll see how they develop. One thing I'd love to talk to you about, Tom, is your many time standings within the world of broadcasting, particularly from the great show Fighting Talk. And you were champion of champions back in May 2011. Must have been a lot of fun that time there. Just talk to us all a little bit about Fighting Talk and your experiences there.
Yeah, no, that was I did do Fighting Talk for a long time. I haven't done it for a long time, but I did. I think eventually I kind of... I think I took the fighting bit a bit too seriously. Do you know what I mean? I was always up for a proper row on there. Do you know what I mean? So maybe that wasn't quite, you know, it was called Fighting Talk, but maybe fighting wasn't exactly what people were after. But no, I had a lot of fun and met some really good people, worked with some really good people who I'm still in touch with, sort of thing. So, and that show was actually, I did me and a mate, produced a football film festival for a couple of years in London. And I remember specifically Fighting Talk, the show in general, and Colin Murray in particular being very, very supportive of that. You know, they came and did a sort of a kicking and screening special edition of Fighting Talk to kind of help publicise the festival. And I remember Colin coming along to, we did a screening of... We did a screening of something at Screen on the Green, and Colin was there, like, selling, you know, we were raising money for the Bobby Moore Fund, and Colin was there, like, going around demanding that people bought raffle tickets and stuff. So it was real enjoyable show to do. For, I think, like all things, you know, there's a certain shelf life and you have a certain time in your life when that works. And I think for quite a few people, once it moved to Manchester, it got a little bit more complicated than being around the corner.
Absolutely. But again, champion of champions back in 2011. So another one for the trophy cabinet.
Yeah.
You mentioned the great writer and the writing talent of Nick Hornby there. And Tom, you are a man who truly understands what it is to be a great writer and a author of 9 books, honing in on that passion for football in particular. But I've got to ask you about your experience ghostwriting for David Beckham's autobiography. How did that come to be?
I knew David a bit. I knew his agent very well. His agent then, fantastic man called Tony Stevens, who every other agent working at the moment owes a debt of gratitude to him, really. So many things that agents and players take for granted now, Tony basically invented. Do you know what I mean? He was, at the time, by far and away the most successful football agent in the country, looking after Beckham, but also Shearer, David Platt, Michael Bridges, Robbie Keane. I mean, it was... so they knew me, and I think that Tony knew I could write. Me and David got on okay. You know, we'd always kind of got on well when we'd met up. And I think that as well, it was quite... Because, I mean, when we were working on it, David and I, that was... His last season at United, you know, we had imagined that the book would finish with him signing a new contract to spend, basically to spend the rest of his career at Old Trafford. But as it happened, that season was quite dramatic and ended with him leaving and joining Real Madrid. So just as well, I think Tony was very aware that generally, you know, ghostwriters are often, in respect of football, are often... writers on newspapers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Tony was aware. I wasn't. I wasn't a journalist. Although I'd done journalism in the past, at the time, I wasn't, and I was never staff at a newspaper. I think Tony was probably quite aware that a lot of the stuff that we needed to talk about would be quite sensitive. A lot of the stuff would be stuff that you wanted nobody to know about until the book came out. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there was a sense of, well, I'll be a safe pair of hands because I'm not beholden to anyone. I'm not going to get pressure from my editor saying, oh, so what really happened when, you know, in the dressing room after that Arsenal Cup tie, when the boot got kicked across the dressing room by Alex Ferguson? That I'm not under that kind of pressure. Do you know what I mean? And also, I guess my experience of being in EastEnders, perhaps, I mean, I was never in the kind of, the whole sort of area that David and Victoria have inhabited for so many years. But I did kind of have a little first person experience myself of the life he leads, that life in the public eye. Do you know what I mean? I think they maybe thought that was something that might prove valuable as well. And so, you know, I just met up with David and we kind of talked, and he asked me questions. I asked him a lot of questions because, you know, obviously you don't go into that if you think either the person is basically wanting you to go away and write it from press clippings. You know, I wanted to make sure that he was going to actually work on it, which was stupid of me to imagine otherwise, because he never takes on anything that he doesn't put his back into. But also to make sure that nothing would get left out, if you know what I mean, that there weren't any. And I know particularly kind of in the arena of his family life, there have been some quite challenging things in, you know, historically in his family life. So and just wanted to make sure that, and, you know, we just said, yeah, let's do it. And we did.
The David Beckham autobiography, My Side, won a special prize at the British Book Awards. So again, another trophy in the Tom Watts cabinet.
Yeah, that was very much, you know, that was about that. I mean, it was actually the award was for fastest selling sports autobiography of all time.
And it does have to be said that there is the David Beckham factor, isn't there, in these things? Tom, one thing I want to move on to, and I'm super grateful for you.
No, actually, you saying that, I should say, Tony, it's really important to... You're absolutely right, there's a David Beckham factor. And it's the measure of him as a person, and actually a measure of his agent at the time, Tony, was that, to be honest, they could have put a Ladybird book out with David's name on the cover and it would have sold a million copies. But instead, they put that book out, which is a book that I know I'm really proud of. And I know that David, even all these years later, is really proud of. Do you know what I mean? And certainly Tony Stevens, who put the two of us together on the project, was really proud of. And, you know, I think there was a lot of, you know, there was quite a lot of stick going around, really, when it became known that I was ghosting the autobiography, and it was kind of, oh, what's that, you know? And actually, people read it and went, no, do you know, that's that. Obviously, any David Beckham book would sell a lot of copies, but that's actually a really good book. And that's not blowing my own trumpet, that's blowing David's trumpet, because he put the hours and was honest enough to make it happen. Do you know what I mean? And well, that, I think that's something very important.
That's the collaborative process, isn't it, in any, you know, ghost written effect, where you didn't have that any agenda yourself. You wanted to discover the true story. And David, as you say, to his credit, everything that he seems to do is with real gusto. And that's why he is where he is. But, you know, again, it's a credit to the combination of the David's openness to you and your ability accordingly to get that comfortable relationship developed.
Yeah.
And again, successes have followed. Obviously, that's touching on, again, an individual at one of the highest echelons of life that you could ever even imagine. I want to just touch on, in closing, a couple of things, and want to go to maybe another end of the world, which I know you're also very passionate about, Tom, as you sit as an advisory board member of Bounce Back, a charity that trains ex-offenders. Talk to me a bit about your role there and this important charity.
Yeah, well, I must admit my role there is not as significant as it might be. It's a fantastic organisation. Not exactly, I mean, it is a charity, but it's more a social enterprise, to be perfectly honest. I've helped in any way I could over the, you know, over the years. I know the founder, a wonderful woman called Francesca Findlater, who founded Bounce Back, which has grown out of all recognition. And it just seemed to, and you know, I used to do kind of prison visits with it's just stuff where they needed, to be honest, where they needed someone who could kind of walk and talk and be a public face for the organisation from time to time. Not least because there'd be a Christmas party every year for all the lads who were working with Bounce Back, and with a kind of mock awards ceremony. Do you know what I mean? I would host that every Christmas. So I wouldn't say I've not been involved, as it were, in guiding Bounce Back in any way. Oh, Francesca doesn't need help with that. And she's got fantastic staff. And of course, the lads themselves have been, you know, it's just something that, but what's amazing about Bounce Back is that it's not unique. There's a lot of, there's a lot of charities and social enterprises doing great work inside prisons and outside prisons with ex-offenders. Bounce Back, the great thing about Bounce Back is it does both. It works with offenders prior to release and then with ex-offenders after release. And the whole thing was predicated on the fact that there is a massive skill shortage in the construction industry in this country. So basically, if you have the skills to be a painter, a decorator, a drywaller, a plasterer, you never need to be out of work. And, you know, so much of ending up, you know, whether it's in Brixton or Wandsworth or Wormwood Scrubs or wherever it is, so much is about not having had the right training at the right time, not having had the right opportunity at the right time, and instead choosing the wrong opportunity at the wrong time. Francesca recognized this skills shortage. She then recognized that what was needed was not just to train the guys in those, you know, in, as I say, painting and decorating, drywalling, plastering, all those kind of skills, but also to support them into employment on the other side. So once they came out. So what Fran did was she put trainers into prisons who were often themselves ex-offenders. She put trainers into prisons, actually talked prisons into building little kind of units within the prison, so that the lads could actually practice on the real thing. Do you know what I mean? This wasn't classroom work. This was actually learning on the job.
Hands on.
And then on release, you'd come out and then you would be supported one of two ways. Either Francesca managed to establish really good relationships with a lot of kind of house builders and stuff, who were always looking for, as I say, people to finish off new estates or whatever it was, people in the construction industry. And what she did was say, look at my lads and believe in my lads and don't prejudge my lads. Give them the opportunity. And they did. And likewise, Bounce Back actually functions and still functions to this day, actually as a company in its own right on smaller jobs. So you can go to Bounce Back and get your front room painted if you want. Do you know what I mean?
Brilliant.
And that opportunity and that support, both inside and on release, is it's a really, really good organisation that's growing all the time, to be fair.
Is there a website so we can learn more about their great work?
Oh, I think it's just bounceback.org or something like that. Bounce Back, all one word, and you'll find it. Google Bounce Back and you'll find it.
Fabulous. Just before we let you bounce back into your time and appreciate it for today, another important organisation that we've been championing for a long time is the great work that Michael Wallace, Ashley Levine and a whole array of other people do. We kick off at 3. Again, totally not-for-profit. And I'm getting my walk on for the next month to raise important funds in support.
Oh, yeah, good man. Good man.
I just do my little bit, Tom. It's all we can do.
Nice.
But yeah, in support of Arla Lloyd. And I would encourage everybody to check out www.kickoffat3.co.uk, www.kickoffat3.co.uk, and do your little bit too, be that run, walk, skip, jump, hop, get on your bike, whatever it is, for the next month. Set yourself a personal target and go for it. Every penny counts. It goes to a great cause. Just in closing, Tom, how did you get involved in your kind of ambassadorial role with the good people at Kickoff at 3?
To be perfectly honest, obviously I've been involved with Arsenal's community department since its inception. So since 1986, the guy who founded Arsenal's community department as a professional organisation, the first person, he was actually the first community department leader in British football, a guy called Alan Sefton, who's now an MBE. I guess I met Alan about a week after he got into the job at the old JVC centre behind the South Clock End at Arsenal. And we've been doing stuff ever since, do you know what I mean? And they're still doing, Arsenal's community department's still doing absolutely brilliant, brilliant work. So I've got a kind of awareness of football, what football can do, the power of football within communities and within local communities, and the power of football to sort of break down barriers and to kind of engage people, particularly young people who otherwise might be kind of difficult to reach. Obviously there's, that's seen most significantly as far as Arsenal and indeed professional football generally concerned, is that there's a really good, the Premier League run a thing called the Kicks programme.
Yep.
Well, Premier League, but also Football League clubs run Kicks programmes as well. It's just fantastic. It's basically just providing a safe space. Come along, play football. We're not going to lecture you. We're not going to tell you what to do. But what we are is we're here to listen to you. We're here to establish trusting relationships so that if you need advice, if you need guidance, if you need help, then we can point you in the right direction. And I got contacted by Michael Wallace, and a guy, friend of his called Sean Pascal. They kind of contacted me just via social media and explaining what they were doing. And it, what I've just said about the Kicks program, that's basically what Michael and Ashley are trying to do. Do you know what I mean? But they've got a very specific relationship in mind, which is the relationship between youth and the local community generally with the Metropolitan Police, or indeed the police in other parts of the country as well, because it's spread outside London now. And so, and basically what they're saying is, hey, look, we'll put a tournament on. Just come. Just put, and it's great. Like they had one a couple of weeks ago down at the Met Police Sports Ground down near Croydon. And, it was a team that got put together off an estate, especially for the occasion. It was a team that never played together before. Absolutely. They got put together for this tournament and they won the tournament. Do you know what I mean? It's, that stuff is... And it's inspiring, really, it's, isn't it? Yeah, it is. It is. And to be fair, it's the kind of thing, I mean, it's brilliant that you're raising funds for them, but really what makes it is that it's something, the kind of things that Kickoff at 3 are doing actually don't cost that much in terms of money. What they cost is time and energy and commitment. And that's what Michael and Ashley bring to it. And of course, they talk they talk their counterparts in, you know, boroughs all over London and further afield into doing the same thing. Do you know what I mean? It's great. There are always things that that need money spent on them. But what I really admire with Michael and with Ashley and the other is that it's people who are willing to put the effort in. And that's Michael and Ashley. But it's also the people who put those teams together.
Absolutely.
And get them into the tournaments. And do you know what I mean? It's a really good organisation. It's very close to me. I've got to say, from me, getting to the Met Police Sports Ground is an absolute nightmare. I was going to be there October 18th at the last tournament. And then last minute, I'm thinking, oh, it's going to take me like 3.5 hours to get
there.
It's not
easy. Right?
And it just, and I had work to do and I couldn't get there. But I think they've got another one planned for January. So I'm hoping that I will be able to get along to that one. But in the meantime, I keep in touch with Michael and, you know, try and spread the word about what they're doing. Because it is, you know, football can engage in a way that very few other things can. And they've kind of recognised the power of the game to do that. And are looking to take full advantage of it in the best way. So fair play to them.
Absolutely. We've been long-term supporters. We admire everything that they stand for. For me, every time, sometimes I turn on the news, I do despair, but it gives me hope that there are people like Michael and team doing wonderful, wonderful things. And also, again, the wonderful people at Bounce Back. There are loads of great people. It is an inspiration.
Sure.
Tom, it's been inspiring for me to talk to you on today's special 100th episode of Verum Sport Podcasting. Keep up the eclectic, fascinating work, and I wish you every continued joy and happiness. Thanks for your time.
Tony, thanks very much. I'll just take the work. Ears open. But thanks a lot. Great to talk to you.
Tom, and I wish you well, as I say. Take care. Thanks again.